Welcome to the Deep Dive, brought to you by 88 Diagnoses. We're your shortcut to being well-informed.
Today, we're really locking down the initial management of suspected acute coronary syndrome, or ACS.
Yeah, this is definitely high-stakes medicine. Missing the diagnosis, especially in those first few minutes, well, it can change everything for the patient.
Absolutely critical.
So let's jump right in with the scenario. Picture this. A 65-year-old woman comes into your ED. She's got a known history of type 2 diabetes.
Okay.
For about 4 hours, she's had really bad nausea, vomiting, and just feels incredibly weak. But here's the thing. She denies any chest pain at all. Vitals are stable.
Classic atypical presentation brewing.
So pause and think right now.
Yeah.
What's the one immediate, absolutely non-negotiable diagnostic tool you need to use within 10 minutes of her hitting the door?
Got to be the 12-lead ECG, the electrocardiogram, no question.
Exactly. We're talking door-to-ECG time, 10 minutes max. For this patient, really, the whole diagnosis might hinge on getting that test done fast.
It often does.
So, our mission today is to walk you through the evidence-based steps for suspected ACS. That covers STEMI, ST elevation myocardial infarction, and NSTACs, non-ST elevation ACS.
Right, which includes NSTEMI and unstable angina.
Yeah.
We want to make sure you don't miss that high-risk patient, especially the ones who don't present like the textbook says they should.
All right, let's move into segment one, the 10-minute triage rapid rundown.
So when you're thinking about myocardial ischemia, having institutional guidance is key. The ACAA, that's the American College of Cardiology and American Heart Association, they basically mandate that hospitals need multidisciplinary teams and solid protocols for triage. This isn't just paperwork. These things genuinely save lives.
Okay, here's on the wards tip, hashtag one, a really high-yield action for you. Make sure your hospital has active standing orders for getting a 12-lead resting ECG within 10 minutes of arrival for anyone with symptoms that could possibly be coronary ischemia.
Yes, if those aren't in place, you need to advocate for them. It's that important.
To keep track of those first critical steps, we've got a mnemonic for you. A-E-I-O-U. Simple, hopefully easy to remember.
Right. Stands for the five core immediate actions. Aspirin first.
Then ECG within that 10-minute window.
I for IV access and initial labs.
Oxygen, but only if needed. Check the saturation.
And U for urgent assessment and continuous monitoring. Think of it as your immediate checklist.
Okay, so back to that patient nausea, weakness, no chest pain. When should your suspicion really spike? There's research suggesting rules for prioritizing that immediate ECG, even with vague symptoms.
Yeah, like getting an ECG if the patient is over 50 with shortness of breath, altered mental status, upper arm pain, syncope, or weakness.
Or, and this is crucial, if they're over 80 with abdominal pain, nausea, or vomiting. Seems broad, but it catches those silent MIs.
And that leads us straight into the biggest trap, atypical presentations. It's estimated that up to a third, maybe even more, of confirmed MI patients never report chest pain.
A third, wow.
And these patients tend to be older, often female, or like our vignette patient, they have diabetes.
Okay, here's a statistic that should really stick with you. It fundamentally changes how you might view simple nausea in an older patient.
Lay it on us.
In large studies, patients without chest pain were way less likely to get the right initial therapy. And their in-hospital mortality, it jumps massively. We're talking 23.3% compared to 9.3% for those with classic chest pain.
Wow. So just lacking chest pain literally triples their risk of dying in the hospital.
Triples it.
That really highlights why we have to treat symptoms like weakness or unexplained shortness of breath, especially in high-risk folks, with the same urgency as crushing chest pain.
They're being missed. Often getting delayed reperfusion because ECS isn't suspected early enough.
I actually have a resident anecdote about this. Nearly I burned myself once.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Young female patient came in complaining of sharp pleuritic pain. You know, typically we think that's not cardiac if it's sharp or changes with breathing.
Right. Standard teaching.
But something felt off. Kept a high index of suspicion. Got the workup going. And boom, acute MI. And there's data for this, too. One big study found acute ischemia in 22% of patients who presented with sharp or stabbing pain.
22%. So you can't just dismiss sharp pain outright.
Exactly. It's about the whole picture. We still use OPQRST to characterize the pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, onset, provocation, palliation, quality, radiation, severity, timing. But remember the typical patterns.
Ischemic pain is usually that non-focal discomfort, pressure, squeezing, Maybe the Levine sign, the clenched fist over the chest.
Right. Generally not sharp, fleeting, or knife-like, though my anecdote shows exceptions exist.
And radiation is a big clue, isn't it?
Huge. If pain radiates to an upper extremity, especially both arms, or the lower jaw or teeth, that's highly suggestive. Not usually the upper jaw, interestingly.
And the timing.
Well, stable angina might last just 2 to 5 minutes. ACS usually goes on longer than 30 minutes.
Okay. And while we're gathering history, we also need to quickly think about ruling out those other immediate life threats, right?
Absolutely. Need to exclude things like acute aortic dissection, pulmonary embolism, PE, tension pneumothorax, esophageal rupture. Even a perforating ulcer can sometimes mimic this.
Lots to consider quickly. So if you can't remember everything from this segment, remember this. S1 takeaway. Atypical presentations, especially in females, older adults, and people with diabetes presenting with just dyspnea or weakness, are a leading cause of misdiagnosis and carry a threefold higher mortality. Get that 10-minute ECG immediately.
Okay, moving on to segment two. Medication mayhem and ECG gold standards. Ward wins.
Let's revisit our AEIOU mnemonic, focusing now on the initial meds and the absolute gold standard diagnostic criteria on the ECG.
Sounds good. Let's start with A for aspirin. This is must-know drug info. Give 162 to 325 milligrams of aspirin. Critically, have the patient chew it, then swallow. Do this immediately unless there's a strong reason not to.
Like what?
Well, like an active major bleed or if you have a high suspicion for aortic dissection. Then you hold off.
Got it. Next is I for IV access and labs. Get that IV in, get the patient on a cardiac monitor, and draw blood.
Yep. Need high-sensitivity troponin. That's really the standard biomarker now. Mm. Also, electrolytes, kidney function, a CBC to check hemoglobin and platelets, maybe coags if they're high risk for bleeding.
Okay, now O for oxygen. This is a big one, kind of a rule out myth situation.
Yes. Supplemental oxygen is not for everyone routinely. Only give it if their oxygen saturation is less than 94%.
We used to just put everyone on oxygen, didn't we?
We sure did. But big trials, like the DDAY-02 XAMI trial, showed no mortality benefit. And here's the kicker. Giving too much oxygen, hyperoxia, can actually cause coronary vasoconstriction. Not what you want in an ischemic heart.
Counterproductive. Okay, so on the wards tip, #2, resist the reflex to put oxygen on every chest pain patient. Check the SAT first. If it's 94 or above, they likely don't need it.
Correct. Now, for managing ongoing symptoms, we often read for nitroglycerin or NTG.
Sublingual, right, under the tongue.
Yep, 0.3 to 0.4 milligrams sublingually every 5 minutes, up to a maximum of 3 doses if symptoms persist. But remember, NTG is just for symptom relief.
Wait, really? No mortality benefit. That feels wrong. Doesn't relieving symptoms mean less heart screen?
It does reduce myocardial oxygen demand, theoretically, but the large-scale data just hasn't shown it improves survival. What is crucially important, though, are the contraindications. You absolutely have to know these.
Okay, lay them out.
First, suspected right ventricular infarct, an RV infarct.
Mm-hmm.
These patients are highly dependent on preload, the amount of blood returning to the heart. Nitrates draw preload and can cause sudden severe hypotension.
Preload dependent. Got her. What's the second?
Recent use of phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitors.
Yeah.
PDE 5 inhibitors. Your erectile dysfunction drugs.
Ah, okay. Like sildenafil.
Exactly. Sildenafil or vardenafil use within the last 24 hours is a contraindication. And crucially, tadalafil use within the last 48 hours.
48 hours for tadalafil. Why longer?
Because tadalafil has a much longer half-life. Combining it with nitrates can lead to profound, potentially fatal vasodilation and hypotension. You must ask about these drugs.
Okay, really important safety check, which leads nicely to on the wards tip #3. If you see ST elevation in the inferior leads on the ECG, that's leads 2, 3, and AVF, always, always order right-sided leads, specifically V4R, V5R, V6R.
Why those?
To screen for that RV infarct before you even think about giving nitrates. Non-negotiable safety step.
Makes sense. What about morphine? We used to use it a lot more for chest pain, too.
Yeah, the guidelines have pulled back on that. Morphine should really only be for severe, persistent chest pain that hasn't responded to other measures, like nitrates.
Why the caution?
Well, some registry data, like from the Crusade Registry, suggested an association with higher adjusted risk of death. And there's a key mechanistic concern, too.
Which is?
Morphine can slow down gastric emptying. That might actually delay the absorption and the effect of crucial oral antiplatelet drugs, specifically the P2Y12 inhibitors like clopidogrel or ticagrelor. That could impact reperfusion success. So use it sparingly. Only when necessary.
Good point. Okay, let's nail down the ECG gold standard for diagnosis. This is non-negotiable for exams and the wards. For STEMI.
For STEMI, you need new or presumed new J-point ST elevation in at least two anatomically contiguous leads. That means leads looking at the same area of the heart.
And the amount of elevation matters, right? It's not the same everywhere.
Exactly. In leads other than V2 and V3, you need 0.1 millivolts or more, which is 1 millimeter on standard ECG paper.
Okay. 1 millimeter everywhere else. What about V2 and V3?
It's higher there, and it depends on age and sex. For males 40 or older, you need 0.2 millivea or 2 millimeters. For males under 40, it's even higher, 0.25 millivea or 2.5 millimeters. And for females, it's 0.15 millivea or 1.5 millimeters, regardless of age.
Why the difference in V2, V3?
It helps avoid overdiagnosing STEMI, especially in healthy young men who can have benign early repolarization patterns that cause some ST elevation there normally.
Makes sense. And what about in STEMI criteria on the ECG?
For in STEMI, you're looking for new or presumed new ST depression, specifically horizontal or downsloping, of 0.05 millivea or more, that's half a small box, or T-wave inversion of 0.1 millivea or more, 1 millimeter, in two contiguous leads, especially if there's also a prominent R-wave or the RS ratio is greater than 1.
Okay, clear criteria. So if you can't remember everything from this segment, remember this, S2 takeaway. Nitroglycerin is absolutely contraindicated if PDE5 inhibitors were used recently. Remember 48 hours for tadalafil, or if you suspect a right ventricular infarct based on inferior ECG changes, always check right-sided lead V4R first.
All right, let's jump into segment 3, the stealthy STEMI and the case curveball, case clash.
Okay, this is about recognizing those high-risk ECG findings that aren't classic ST elevation but still demand immediate action.
Whoa.
We call these STEMI equivalents.
Must know objective info here. First big one. A newly identified left bundle branch block, or LBB.
Right. If the patient has symptoms concerning for ischemia and a new LBBB pops up on the ECG, you treat it like a STEMI until proven otherwise.
What else?
A posterior wall STEMI. This one's tricky because it often shows up as ST depression in the anterior leads, V1 through V4.
Wait, depression means STEMI.
In this specific case, yes. Horizontal ST depression in V1, V4. Often with relatively tall R waves in V1 to V3. It's like looking at the reciprocal changes from the back. You need to confirm it by getting posterior leads V7, V8, and V9 and looking for ST elevation there.
Got it. Posterior leads are key. What are the other equivalents?
Two specific patterns to burn into your memory. The Wellens pattern. This shows deep, often symmetrical T-wave inversions in multiple precordial leads, usually V2 and V3. It signals a critical stenosis, usually in the left anterior descending artery, the LAD. The patient might even be pain-free when you see this.
High risk even without pain. Okay, and the last one.
The Duenter sign. This is characterized by tall, peak, symmetric T waves that arise from upsloping ST segment depression, typically seen in leads V2 through V6. Also indicates an acute LAD occlusion. Recognizing any of these means hitting the cath lab activation button, just like a classic STEMI.
Because that initial ECG can be normal, right? Even in someone having an MI.
Absolutely. It's estimated the initial ECG is non-diagnostic in almost half, like 45% of NSTEMI cases.
So what do you do then?
Serial monitoring is vital. You have to repeat the ECG every 15 to 30 minutes if the patient is still having symptoms, or even if they're not, but your clinical suspicion remains high. Things can change fast.
Which brings us back to AEIOU. That U stands for urgent assessment and monitoring.
Exactly. If you spot any of these STEMI equivalents, or that new LBBB, you have to escalate care urgently. Selecting the reperfusion strategy, usually primary PCI, percutaneous coronary intervention, or sometimes thrombolytics cannot wait for troponin results to come back. Time is muscle.
Okay, pause and think prompt, #3. Let's say your patient comes in with symptoms and you know they have a pre-existing LBBD. What non-ECG findings become most critical for diagnosing an acute MI in this situation, and why?
That's a common and tricky scenario. The LBBB itself messes up the standard ECG interpretation for ischemia, right?
Totally obscures it.
So you have to rely heavily on other things. Three main ones. First, the patient's clinical history. Is the story highly suggestive of ACS? Second, cardiac biomarkers. Serial troponins become even more crucial here.
And third?
Third, if you have access to it and the expertise, an emergent bedside echocardiogram.
Why the echo?
Because while the ECG is confusing, the echo can directly visualize the heart muscle. You might see a regional wall motion abnormality, basically. A part of the heart wall isn't contracting properly. That strongly suggests ischemia or infarction in that area, even with the LBBB present.
So the Scarbosa criteria for diagnosing MI and LBBB exist, but they aren't perfect.
Exactly. The Scarbosa criteria look for specific discordant ST changes, but they're known to be specific but not very sensitive, meaning if they're positive, it's likely an MI, but if they're negative, it doesn't rule it out. You can still miss a lot of MIs.
Okay, so on the words tip hashtag four, If a patient has a known LBBB or even a pacemaker, which also complicates interpretation, and they develop ACS symptoms, your default assumption has to be acute ischemia until you can prove otherwise. Don't let the baseline ECG changes falsely reassure you. Use that bedside echo if you can.
All right, let's tie this all together with a case study. We'll call it the diagnostic puddle. You have a 70-year-old man, history of hypertension and high cholesterol. He presents with 45 minutes of constant heavy discomfort right in the epigastric area, the upper abdomen.
Epigastric pain could be lots of things.
Right. He says it radiates up to his lower jaw. He's also diaphoretic, sweaty, vitals, BP 150, 90, heart rate 95.
Okay, step one, evaluation and rule out options. Given that epigastric pain and sweating, what are those immediate life-threatening non-ACS diagnoses you need to consider quickly?
Go think about aortic dissection, esophageal rupture like Borhave syndrome, maybe a perforating ulcer. Those need rapid assessment.
So while you're considering those, you also start the standard ACS protocol, right?
Absolutely. Initiate monitoring, get that 10-minute ECG ordered, and give him the 325-milligram aspirin to chew. AEIOU in action.
Step two, ECG curveball. The ECG comes back quickly. It shows clear ST elevation in leads 2, 3, and AVF.
Okay, that's an inferior wall STEMI. Diagnosis made. What's the next immediate step?
Immediate cardiology activation for reperfusion, usually the cath lab. But before you reach for the nitroglycerin for his discomfort, what two crucial safety steps must you take based on what we discussed?
Okay, inferior MI. Got to worry about RV involvement. So step one, ask about recent PDE5 inhibitor use. Step two, get those right-sided ECG leads, V4R, V5R, V6R.
Perfect. Now, scenario branching, the rule out in action. What if lid V4R comes back showing 0.5 milliV or more of ST elevation? That confirms RV infarct.
Okay, confirmed RV infarct. Now what? Rule out option. Giving NTG is now contraindicated. It's preload dependent. That NTG could cause his blood pressure to crash catastrophically.
So what do you do?
The priority shifts slightly. You still need reperfusion arranged urgently, but for immediate management, you focus on fluid resuscitation, give IV fluids cautiously to support that preload and pain control, maybe carefully considering morphine if needed, but no nitrates. You've just avoided a major complication.
Excellent. Now, step three, management branch. Let's rewind. What if that initial ECG was totally normal, but his epigastric pain is persisting?
Okay, initial ECG normal, patient still symptomatic. Rule out option. You absolutely cannot rule out ACS based on a single normal ECG.
So what's the protocol?
You follow the NSTS pathway, repeat the ECG every 15, 30 minutes, wait for those serial high sensitivity troponin results. Those will help you stratify his risk and differentiate between unstable angina, if troponins stay negative, versus an enstema, if troponins become positive. Continue monitoring closely.
Great walkthrough. So if you can't remember everything from this segment, remember this S3 takeaway. For a confirmed STEMI or a STEMI equivalent on ECG, getting rapid reperfusion, either PCI or thrombolytics, is the absolute priority. Never delay calling cardiology or starting the reperfusion process while waiting for biomarker results.
All right, time for the memory blast recap. Let's do a rapid fire drill.
Go for it.
10-minute ECG is mandatory for possible ischemia.
Aspirin dose, 162 to 325 milligrams. Chewed immediately.
Oxygen only if O2 saturation is less than 94%. Remember, hyperoxia can cause vasoconstriction.
Hydroglycerin is a no-go with recent PDE5 inhibitors 48 hours for tadalafil or suspected RV infarct. Check V4R first.
STEMI criteria. J-point elevation thresholds in V2, V3 depend on age and sex. 1 millimeter elsewhere.
Atypical presentations. Young females, diabetics, older adults presenting with just dyspnea or weakness, high risk for misdiagnosis, higher mortality.
Serial ECGs every 15, 30 minutes are crucial if the first ECG is non-diagnostic, but symptoms continue or suspicion is high.
Excellent recap.
And our final provocative thought for you. Remember that the most frequent reason MIs are missed is an atypical presentation. So the next time you see an older patient complaining only of nausea or weakness, remember that 23.3% mortality figure we talked about. That immediate 12-lead ECG you order could literally save their life by catching it early.
Powerful reminder. Okay, listeners, hit the words with one tip you learned today. Tonight, quiz yourself on that AEIOU mnemonic and definitely DM us your clutch moments or even your epic fails we learned from those two at 88 Diagnoses.
Follow us on Instagram at 88 Diagnoses. That's DIAGNOSES, plural. Join the conversation there and share your insights.
Thanks for tuning in to The Deep Dive.